Welcome everyone to House Call, a Crit Rate podcast. This is episode number 8. I'm your host, Justin Skirbo, and I'm joined by our co-host, Justin Chow.
What's up?
And today we have the pleasure of sitting down and hanging out with Jared from Avalanche Reviews. Jared, hey. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks for having me. This is a nice hotel room.
I know.
It was a mess before, and it's still a mess, and I appreciate the compliment regardless. There are things hidden beyond this door. Don't worry about it.
You don't want to know what's behind that door.
Of course.
This is the Tokyo edition, too.
Yes, listeners. We are coming to you live, not live, but from Shinjuku, Tokyo, the new, you know, where Jared's living now, you know.
My stomping grounds. This area specifically, Shinokubo, is where I used to go to school, so.
Is that right?
Yeah, when you told me where you were, I was like, oh, cool, I could get there quick, because I know exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It is actually interesting to see, like, while we're walking around, we got here on a Thursday, so we were in during, like, I guess the work week, like the weekdays. Mm. And it's interesting to see as we're out, like the times of, like, people going to work or school and then coming out of work at school and, like, when all the restaurants are popping off and everything seems to open up way later than we think, and getting breakfast is very difficult.
Tokyo is a late to open
city. Yeah.
That's for sure. That's for sure. We're trying to go get breakfast at, like, 8 o'clock and there's, like, nothing.
So there's a few places that you can get good food early in the morning. Most of them are like gyudon places, beef bowls.
Yeah.
So Sukiya, Matsuya, Yoshinoya. Okay. A lot of those open up early or even stay open 24 hours sometimes.
Is that right?
Yeah. I have a Matsuya in my neighborhood. Very residential, low-key, quiet neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a 24-hour Matsuya just right there at the
station. That's amazing.
It's cool.
So let's get into a little bit about sort of your journey into Japan. What's got you living here now? I mean, quite a different location from where you were before. Where did you
South Florida?
South Florida. Okay, so quite
what
a journey.
A difference.
So I mean, obviously, you know, Japan's like the mecca for gamers like us. You know, it's where everything, all of our favorite stuff comes from.
We love JRPGs. You're definitely here in droves.
Yeah, I feel like the pull to come here is very strong for anybody that's in that's in the space. But it's something else entirely to totally upend your life and come here and start to, you know, assimilate and get used to it. So what has that process been like for you?
Surprisingly easy.
Yeah?
I mean, easier than I thought it would be. I figured it would drain me, you know, completely dry. But I will say I have a wife who, because, you know, I was doing the YouTube stuff, she's like, how about you take care of, get the bills paid, and when it comes time to apply for visas or the school that we went to and stuff, she was handling the paperwork side of things, which,
yeah,
I imagine I'd be answering very differently if I did it on my own.
Mm-hmm. I hear that. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's teamwork, man. That's teamwork.
Yeah.
So did you know the language before you got here, or is it something that you were just kind of like, you know what, let's just dive in head first and figure it out?
How's your Japanese now?
I thought I did until I came here and had to, like, talk to people at the post office. Things other than, like, how much does this ramen cost?
Right.
So we started, we get our visa through, or we used to get our visa through a Japanese language school. Mm-hmm. So I figured, you know, I'll start at, like, level 2 or something, something kind of down.
No.
Absolutely not. Level 1 was hard.
Mm-hmm. I believe it,
A lot of the stuff that I learned was like phrases. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know sentence structure or how to string something together and little grammatical things, how to conjugate verbs. Mm-hmm. Like I knew how to say, where is this?
Yeah.
But I didn't know that there's like 3 versions of where.
Okay. Yeah.
Because what?
There's the area around me, there's the area near you, and then there's the area away from both of us. And those are 3 different words.
Weird. Okay.
It's interesting to think too, because like I definitely have in my phone a bunch of phrases to like say to people, and this is kind of like how I'm having my time and trying to speak the language. I also realize I don't understand the answers.
Yeah, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
When you ask, you know, nani nani wa doko desu ka, you have to understand, well, all right, you go here straight and you hang a left.
And you're like,
yeah.
I didn't think this far.
That's one of the things I ran into when I used to visit here on, you know, me and my wife would come here like once every 2 years. And I was like, yeah, I know Japanese. And then you get here and you have to ask a question that you've been practicing like on the plane or in your mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he comes back with a response and Japanese is fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it'll hit you pretty hard.
But the moment they think that you actually understand Japanese. So, it's weird because, like, when I try, they're like, oh, you have some Asian look about you. Mm-hmm. I'm Chinese. And they immediately go into it. And I'm just like, I can't even pick out words.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's a rough language to get on a like a street level.
Yeah.
If you watch the news, it's a little more easy to understand. But if you talk to someone and ask where something is on the street, unless it's like, I mean, even older people, man, it's insane. It's a language that kind of strings together. So it's like every word is like rapid fire. And there's very polite versions of words and then just sort of casual versions. And then Tomodachi Kotoba, which is like friend language.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. There's the casual. So I totally I think I understand where you're coming from. Because like when I was in China, there is like the Chinese like news and it's very articulate, like they're saying every like sound and they're doing it like in a structure that you recognize, and then you go into the casual conversations and they're missing things and you're just supposed to know from the inferences.
Exactly, yes, that's 100% it. And it's a very like high context language, so I guess it's low context. I mean, the point is they will leave out things like mine or your
if it's just like and understood. They'll just say,
"Dad, how is?" would be the direct translation. Yeah. Okay. And you would know, oh, my dad is fine, you know. But it's a lot of the languages, when you get down to the casual level, you're dropping the pleasantries, you're dropping the particles, and then it's just you're getting straight to, like, laptop. Oh, yeah, my laptop's over there. You can use it. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
It's a very, like, low-context verbally language, but...
They just kind of expect you to know.
It's a high awareness.
Let's call it that. That's got to be really hard. But I assume that's going to come as you start to kind of like acclimate like culturally, right? Like as you start to, you know, get used to the way that people are speaking, or you just kind of expose yourself to it more. Has there been any sort of barriers for you in that way as far as like, you know, kind of acclimating with the culture? I mean, obviously, you know.
Reading, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, the characters.
It's tough. And I have dyslexia, so I have a problem reading English.
Okay.
So that's already a problem.
Are the characters easier with dyslexia?
They can be, if my mind is able to attach them to what they mean.
I see. Yeah.
So for some reason, the kanji for mizu, which is water, looks like something that would be flowing like water to me, or drops of water falling onto a surface. And I'm like, yeah, no problem, easy. I'll read that every time.
Yeah.
But if there's a lot of strokes involved, that a lot of small details packed into a small area, my mind will confuse the idea of a vertical or a horizontal.
I see. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's going to be challenging then. Yeah.
So like when I go to write kanji, oftentimes I'll... Like, yeah, I remember it completely perfect this way. And then it's like, no, it's horizontal. You don't do the stroke that way.
So is it like you're making the characters, but you're making them, like flipped?
Not necessarily, because the characters aren't a single thing to my mind. They're made up of several. You see all the strokes instead of, like, the whole symbol itself.
And that's how you're supposed to read it, too, right? Like, it's almost like layers.
Yeah, there's radicals and stuff that... Once you latch on and figure out the radicals, if you don't know the entire kanji, there's an aspect of it that's written in the same way in other kanjis. And like 9 times out of 10, it's pronounced like those other kanjis.
That's wild. Yeah, it's funny. So this is my first time in Japan, like ever. So as we're riding the trains and stuff, I see the advertisements going, and they're flashing these characters so fast. And I'm like, how could they? Yeah. Like, and I think about how we see stuff like in the US and the way that advertisements roll, and it's like, I guess I can read things that quickly. I'm not really thinking about it, but to see something that's like totally foreign to me is so bizarre.
It's interesting because like I feel like with the characters for like just a newspaper, just to read a newspaper, you need to know like 10,000 different characters just to like be able to get through a page of it.
So from what I hear, you only need 3,000 characters. You need to remember 3,000 characters in order to get by everyday life, read the newspaper, watch the news and stuff like that.
3,000 seems way more doable than 10,000.
Yeah, but there are more than 10,000. I think there are more than... I don't want to say that. Maybe it's 8,000. It's a ridiculous number of kanji. And even 3,000, I might know 400 kanji maximum. And if that's really pumping my numbers up.
Yeah.
So I couldn't imagine getting to the point where it's 3,000.
So for our listeners who don't know who Avalanche is, or Jared, right? So he does Avalanche reviews on YouTube. He does a lot of video game reviews and documentaries, a lot of content on some of the retro stuff. Are you going to be doing a Japanese edition where you start speaking and doing Avalanche Japanese reviews?
You know, I thought about it. It would be a great challenge. And probably when I get mega comfortable with the language, but as it is now, I can't articulate myself very well.
That's fair.
And I mean, it would be nerve-wracking to put spoken Japanese on the internet.
Yeah. Where it would for other people to dissect.
Rightly get dissected.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I've thought about doing it. And for sure, when I really get a grasp on things, as it is now, I can have conversations with people, but in a broken sort of way.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a, do you guys know about the concept of katakana?
That's one style
I've
of writing,
heard
right?
That yes. word before.
It's, well, yeah, yeah. It's one of the alphabets, and it's for like foreign words, like toilet,
toilet.
Yeah. So katakana. Hmm. This is a hack for anybody who might want to come to Japan. If you pronounce a word with katakana, you have a 50-50 shot of the person knowing exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
So, for example, I lost my my Zyru card. Your like passport essentially here.
Mm. Yeah.
Which sucked. I lost it at
is that like a driver
station?
Like his driver's license
yeah,
equivalent?
Like my resident card.
Yeah, I see.
Okay.
So I lost that and it was awful. So, but I had to tell the station attendant, there's like a little button on the wall and a little speaker you could talk to the station attendant.
Mm. Yeah.
And I could say, "Hey, I'm sorry, but I my Zyu card, I didn't know how to say lost." So I was like, oh, sumimasen, watashi no zairyu kado ga rosto shimashita. And
she got it?
Like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Heck yeah.
I'll come out and help you find it. Like,
what was that word?
Lost.
Oh, you found, okay.
Rosto.
You literally just, I see
if
what you're
you
saying.
If you pronounce a word in what I would, it's just a stereotypical Japanese accent.
Yes.
You literally might.
See, it almost reads as like offensive to me
yeah.
or something.
It does. It really does. But like if you're looking for like a hotel, like or even the word hotel, you can use katakana, hoteru.
Yeah.
So like if you learn a little bit of katakana, just words that you're interested in, donutsu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like if you learn little stuff like that, the majority of Japanese people will understand what you're saying, even though you're not speaking Japanese.
Interesting.
That's cool. That's
so
a
really
nice
cool.
little hack.
That's
yeah.
amazing.
Beer, biru.
Yes.
Yep.
It's funny because like also people, I remember listening to somebody say Final Fantasy and they're like, Final Fantasy. And
yep.
I was like, that can't be right.
Yep.
That's
yeah.
what it, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Biohazard, biohazard.
That's yeah. So that it,
oh, this is some important context also for our listeners about Avalanche. So primarily the content that you do tends to float around JRPG world, survival horror world, all of these kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But originally rooted in PlayStation, Super Nintendo, things
oh, yeah.
like this. But obviously it's broken out from that in various directions over time. One of the questions that I had is, so since we've been in Japan, it's actually been a lot easier to get around speaking English. Almost everyone speaks, at least to some degree.
Yeah.
Do you find yourself falling into it if you don't know the Japanese, like, or what you're trying to say completely? Or are you trying to like be as, you know, diligent as you can?
Yeah, I do try to be strict because you can get by using English, but so the problem is it makes it more awkward because I'm like, oh, could you wait while I look this word up, please?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
while I translate a kanji that I don't know how to read. But I've gotten really good at describing stuff without knowing the words for it.
Because
with Japanese, there's a lot of very hyper-specific words that don't use components that make up, like, for example, a meeting room. A room that you have a meeting in, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
English is very descriptive with our names for stuff. This is a fishing pole. It is literally a pole you use to fish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We have a lot of words that are made up of the actions that describe the word. With Japanese, we have a meeting room. It is a room and meeting, and those two words exist in the language, but put them together, they don't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
You have they have as a specific word for meeting
a
room,
separate
right?
yeah. word
yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So that being the case, it's very hard for me to know a lot of hyper specific vocabulary like that, so I've gotten good at describing
a
the
room
things that I'm talking about.
Gotcha.
Like a
okay.
room that people would meet in and they're like, oh, you mean
yeah exactly. So when you do that, when you start to learn descriptive words and how to describe like verbs and actions,
mm-hmm.
you can probably get by with a pretty limited amount of Japanese.
Okay.
Can I ask, how has your wife's Japanese become or been?
She started at
zero.
She's,
oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was telling her, because I was learning Japanese for years.
Was it your idea to move to Japan?
You know what? So interestingly, it was my dream to move to Japan, but it was her idea, which is weird.
What a great wife. That's amazing.
She's an incredible wife. And this is kind of like a tangent, but when we first visited Japan, we were getting married. Mm-hmm. And she was in the process of planning the wedding and who, you know, what family members can sit together, who hates each other, venue and stuff like that. And she was like, man, this is a lot of work.
Yeah.
So she goes, well, how would you feel if we took all the money we would spend on a wedding and just went to Japan?
Yeah, right.
And I had always been into wanting to come here, but the concept that you could just get on a plane and go there for a little bit and come back, it was, I mean, it never occurred to me.
Yeah.
You know, and we, you know, we're pretty not great off financially at the time, so it wasn't even like something that I could,
we could to have be a option.
Vacation. No, it wasn't even an idea. And then, so we came here for the first time. We're in here in Shinjuku. We stayed at the Shinjuku Prince Hotel.
Okay.
Which I stop at the station that's attached to the Shinjuku Prince Hotel every day to go to school. So it's very nostalgic and cool.
Yeah.
It's awesome. But when we stepped off the train, we were walking out into Shinjuku. Me and my wife both kind of like looked at each other, and it was just like a sort of, I think this is it.
You know, that's awesome. Wow.
So we had our ceremony here. We got married here in Odaiba.
That's awesome.
In front of the giant Gundam statue.
That's amazing. Really cool. Amazing.
We literally just went there yesterday. Yeah, we just went there.
Isn't Odaiba awesome?
It's so cool. It's like, so cool.
It's like Miami South Beach, but really clean and nice, and no one robs you.
So is she like a gamer and into this kind of stuff too?
Very much.
Very cool.
She's a big nerd. Just on the side, going to the Gundam statue and seeing, it's way different than the Tokyo that we've been seeing so far. You go far out there, and it does, like, even the buildings out there seem very, like, I don't know, we kept saying like brutalism or like that brutalistic architecture is very blocky and cement, and it's like perfect for like a Gundam like statue.
Yeah. Odaiba's interesting because it's kind of a project city.
Interesting.
And I think Odaiba is reclaimed land as well. One of the airports is, but they essentially just pushed a bunch of garbage, and not garbage, but you know, like dirt and stuff, and cement into the ocean.
That's interesting.
And there's a lot of reclaimed land here in Japan.
Very cool. Okay.
Yeah, and but Odaiba was like, after they built the area up, they kind of were like, let's turn it into like a concept city or something.
Yeah.
That's why you
can
go
totally
there.
Feels like that.
Yeah. You could go into and it's very high end too. So there's a donut shop there. Me and my wife love walking by, but the donuts are about like $16.
What?
Oh,
wow.
For plain donuts, no frosting.
That's wild.
Are they good? Like,
I've never bought one.
You're, you're eating $16. Yeah, we're talking US dollars.
Yeah, we are. Yeah.
Okay. Also, that has been a phenomenally, like, pleasant surprise since we got here, just how cheap a lot of stuff is. Like,
The yen is very low right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, the dollar isn't doing amazing, but it's definitely doing better than the yen. So. Yeah.
Well, it's like, I mean, we're from, like, tri-metropolitan New York City area, so, like, when we go out for ramen there, first of all, it doesn't even hold a candle to what we're getting out here, but it's like a bowl of ramen's, like, $22 or something. But then we go down the street here and we have the best ramen I've ever had in my life for $8.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, are you kidding
insane.
Me?
Yeah. Even, you know, like, and to your point, exactly. In America, the best ramen you can get is a hole in the wall random spot here in Tokyo that is probably like, if I'm around it, I'll eat there.
Yeah.
Versus like the best ramen I've had here is a chain restaurant in my neighborhood called Hidakaya.
Yeah.
And it's a 500-600 yen bowl of ramen. It comes out to like around $4.
How is that possible?
And it's the best ramen I've ever had in my life.
That's so cool.
It's incredible. But yeah, the exchange rate is killer right now. So what we do is I get paid in a U.S. bank account.
Amazing.
And every month I transfer it over.
Oh,
and,
man, so you're balling.
I'm making money on the transfer.
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
It feels illegal. But
the arbitrage is real.
I looked it up to make sure. Yeah. There's no rules against it.
So when people ask you what you do for a living, are you like, oh, I'm a Forex trader? Like,
I mean, I try to say like, oh, I edit video. If they're not familiar with like video game YouTube or anything, that requires a lot less questions.
Yeah.
Than, like, what kind of content do you make? Because then they assume I'm like, you know, Mr. Beast, and I build a private island that people can like have an obstacle course on or something.
Yeah. It's a lot of questions. Mm. And it's difficult to speak on that in Japanese, I'm sure.
Is there a deep like Japanese YouTube community?
There wasn't for a while, but YouTube has started to blow up here. They had their own video sharing website for the longest time, and YouTube was just kind of second fiddle.
Yeah.
But recently, or really when people started to make really good careers out of YouTube is when Japan started really adopting it. Mm. There's a YouTube studio here in Tokyo that you can rent time at. So
really?
It must be doing well enough.
Have you gone there?
I haven't gone there, no. I don't ever do anything that ever requires like a big production or a camera.
Mm. And I was going to say, you're not so much on camera, right? It's mostly video stuff.
Yeah. Almost never. I stream and I have like a webcam, so I'm not like completely hidden from the internet.
But yeah.
Yeah, I never really... In my videos, it's always about how's the game look, how's it play, here's the history of the game.
And yeah.
My face is almost never required for any of that.
With a voice like yours, you know? Yeah, I feel like it does a lot of the speaking for you.
What was the biggest like transition for you? Like we've been systematically every night watching like an hour or two of like Japanese television, and it's so wholesome, and everyone is so nice, and it's like, it's funny, but it's clean, and it's interesting. I don't know. It seems way different than like we go to America, and like the advertisements are plentiful, and it's like very much trying to sell you stuff. And I feel like the entertainment here, I mean, given how much TV do you watch?
So I kind of stopped watching TV.
Yeah.
I found Japanese TV to be really annoying once you've gotten used to what the programming is like. You've probably seen, you had to have, most Japanese television are these like variety shows where you have a panel of guests.
Yes.
And like 75% of those shows, their runtime is spent sending a, sending a guy out, like a man on the street type of deal to a Japanese restaurant. Mm-hmm. And then he'll eat some food and they'll do like a little piece on the restaurant or the type of food or the traditional way it's made.
What we were watching yesterday was about a train.
It was in this very pleasant looking nice girl riding different trains.
Yeah.
That was the whole thing. They love it. So that's the format is you have like a panel of like four, they call it talento. So like they hang out and then they watch this person who went out and did a man on the street style documentary thing or interview thing, and they just react. It's reaction YouTube. And once you figure that out,
oh, that's totally
you
true.
Can't watch it.
Yeah,
I hear that.
So I find it annoying, but I found that Japanese advertisements I love. So when I'm on the train, I'm constantly watching a little LCD screen, looking at whatever's coming out and trying to imagine myself like, maybe I'll catch that anime, you know, on Thursdays at 7 or whatever.
Yeah.
I want to kind of have a normal Japanese person schedule, kind of feel like I'm fitting in.
There you go. I'd love to steer us towards a little bit more video games.
Let's get into it. In the same respect.
So, I mean, obviously now you're in Japan, right? Are you importing English games? Or like, can you even get English games around here? Are you just like...
Great question.
When RE4 Remake comes out, are you getting the Japanese version? Like, what's happening there?
So, there's a few hoops you have to jump through in order to play English video games here sometimes. It depends.
Okay.
With, like, let's say, like, Xbox, PS4, PS5, whatever, you might find a U.S. release game at a secondhand shop here.
Okay.
But for the most part, it's rare. It's the same. You pay the same price as you would for a Japanese game in America, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they can be hard to get a hold of here physically, so I end up having to sometimes... I have a Discord server for the people who support me on Patreon and YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be like, hey guys, does anybody have a copy of, you know, Doom 3 on Xbox or whatever?
Yeah.
Like, I need it now. And sometimes shipping's like 2 weeks on eBay or something. Yeah. So it can be hard to get physical, like retro games for US releases when I need them. But it can be kind of interesting to get PC games on like Steam or the Epic Store. Because a lot of times your region that you're downloading it from decides what version of the game you get.
I was just going to say, so
and
if you're
RE4 is heavily censored, RE4 Remake, RE2 Remake, heavily censored.
Really?
Yeah, like that scene in RE2 Remake where the guy is, you're pulling him through where the shutter is and he gets ripped in half.
Yeah, yeah.
When you pull him through in the Japanese version, it's just the rest of his body. He has blood on his torso.
Oh, that's lame.
It's hardcore. Yeah, that is a little lame.
No decapitation, limbs don't come off in order for you to get a good Sero rating here.
So when you're on like PSN, do you have to like, I don't know, use like a VPN or something to like pretend you're in like a US...
For like the PSN, you have to have like a hardware VPN at that point, which I don't mess with.
Okay.
So at that point, you can... I think my account is a US account. And you can change your system language... I believe on consoles, the system language is what decides what version of the PSN you get.
Okay. Oh, so if you buy like an NTSC PS5, yeah. bring it here, then like you're just in.
You should be fine. That's not bad. Even if you buy a Japanese PS5, they're not region locked.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But like if you access the PlayStation Store there and you download RE4, yeah, you're getting the
as long as I have my US PSN account.
Gotcha. Oh, okay.
Gotcha. Okay.
So that's pretty, it's relatively
simple. That's simpler, mm-hmm. yeah.
Unless I need to get a PSN game that's Japanese and I have to create a new PSN account and new like account on my PS5 or whatever. But on Steam, there are very specific settings I have to use in order to download. I have to set my download region to America. Mm. And on the plus side, I get Japanese prices for games.
Oh, true. So that, little.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's amazing.
And when you're playing or paying in US dollar for the Japanese price, you're set.
Is it also like you get the game a day and a half, like a day earlier, 12 hours earlier?
Yeah, around 12 hours earlier.
That's pretty rad.
What are new games? What's the MSRP in yen right now?
Man, I've seen it like a. For
like a new
like translated new. Into dollars, I've seen it like at like 79 bucks.
Okay,
it's crazy. Oh. Brand new games here are expensive. Anything, yeah. Interestingly, like we were talking about before building a PC here in Japan, computer parts are like double,
astronomical,
really,
yeah, I'm
double
sure.
the price in the US.
Really,
interesting. I think they don't have as good of a trade relationship with China or Taiwan and China, mm-hmm. which makes sense why import fees would cause. Prices to be so high, but with video games, I don't know if it's, they have to be domestically manufactured here,
right?
But for some reason they cost like an easy $20 more than US games.
It's funny because like, well, so in China, when I was in China, right, they would manufacture everything in China, but you'd be buying it from America, so they'd be shipping it from like for like some phones and stuff, and this was back in like 2013 or something like that. Mm. But there would be like, I'm making the stuff in China, and then it gets shipped to America, and then it's getting shipped back to China so that you could buy it there. So I assume that it was like the import export situation plus the double shipping, like that's the prices. But yeah, I'm not sure how Japan works. That would be crazy if it's making from China. It would be like over what, just a little over a body of water, I'm assuming. I don't know.
It's very weird. Yeah, I figure. Because of the close proximity, I'd pay less in shipping.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's. I think it's just all the whether or not Japan puts a certain tax on whatever comes in and out from China. Mm-hmm. I assume America trading so much with China, it's got a. We have better deals, I got to imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, a video card. I mean, I just bought a 4090, which is already way too much money, no matter where you're buying it.
Yeah.
But here, it's. Astronomical. It was roughly double.
Damn.
Wow, that's crazy.
Okay, when you got here though, like the first couple of weeks, maybe the first couple of months, was there any particular like game hunting quests that you were going on? Was there anything here that you wanted to get that you can just get here? Do you collect Japanese games?
I do, yeah. I haven't been actively collecting in a while. Mm. What I do now is if I'm out with some friends and I'm in Akihabara, mm-hmm. I'll stop by the hot spots like Mandarake and gamers, and if I find something cool, like, oh yeah, that PS3 game, it's an old shoot 'em up or something, mm-hmm. I'll grab it, but I don't actively go out looking for games unless I'm doing a video on them.
Okay. So, man, because I was going to say, when we got here, it was very hard, like the first time going through Akihabara, it's like sensory overload. I mean, there's just so much stuff that you could get into.
Yeah.
It's almost like, how do you really like contain yourself as far as like what kind of stuff you want to
the wallet is just always open.
That's the problem too, is in Akihabara what gets me most is if you go to like Book Off, which is like a secondhand shop,
yeah, mm-hmm.
there'll be anime figures there, video game figures there, like Persona 5 figures that you'll pay pennies on the dollar for. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and that's what really has me constantly pulling my wallet
out.
Video the deals
games, they kind of figured out that people were coming here to get import games to save on internet prices.
Yeah.
And a lot of the shops have started pricing accordingly now.
Yeah, that's what Justin was saying.
Yeah, I saw like Super Potato. It's like, it's absurd. But yeah. I think that it's because everybody knows that that's the spot, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and Super Potato, they were way worse for a while. Their prices have gone down recently, which is good. Mm-hmm. I think it's because with Corona, people couldn't come here readily. So, and Super Potato was like, we can't keep those, visitor prices anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm sure things have slowly gotten back up. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty. If you're gonna find a deal here now, it's not at a gaming place. It's at like a Hard Off or a Book Off, like a secondhand store.
Yeah,
where they don't know what they have.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes they will, but if you go to like a small area, like can't think of anything off the top of my head, but if you stay in Tokyo and go to, like, where I live in Nakano, there's a book off that's just a little one-story, very small. It might be the size of this little hotel room here.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, I might find a PS1 game there that I would pay $300 for.
Really?
That I could get for, like, you know, 4,000 yen, 40 bucks or something.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, you'll find that, but in a video game shop, you're guaranteed that $300 price no matter what.
Yeah. Mm. Did you get any big scores lately? Like...
Not that I can think of off the top of my head. I've been buying like really just kind of novelty stuff. Like the Resident Evil and Resident Evil Zero remake remasters that came out.
They came
out physically here in Japan as a collection. And I don't know if it was the same in the West, but I was like, oh yeah, I don't own these physically, the remastered versions. Yeah. That's all digital, so yeah, have that. There's a collection where it's like RE4 remaster. One of the light gun games, I think it was Darkside Chronicles, PS3 version or something like that. Yeah. There's like a big collection. So I bought that, like, kind of novelty stuff when I come across it now.
Dude, I feel like we are like kindred spirits, man. It's like, I mean, when we first found you with all of the Eon stuff, all the types of games that you cover is exactly the same, like, world I'm in. So nice. I'm like hanging on each word that you've got because I'm like, oh, there's going to be some nuggets of wisdom here that I want to take back to the store.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, so he did take the crit rate test, and you did get Ascendiary. So did you have a chance to steer it a little bit closer to crit rate, .io, you took the test, and you ended up getting Ascendiary. So did you get a chance to, like, look through some of the criterias? Did they make sense?
Yeah. The criterias felt like they make sense for me. There was one specifically where it said, I forget the exact wording, but it's like... the game doesn't necessarily have to be like, it doesn't have to function incredibly, but the world can be, you know, amazing or something like that.
Yeah.
And that one, because you know, you have the little bars and then you have the two kind of opposite.
Yeah, extreme left and extreme right.
And then it was further towards the, you know, broken game, amazing game world.
Yeah.
Which is
story versus
stalker
mechanics.
Fan.
Yeah.
100% accurate.
Totally.
Yeah. So I feel like it definitely, and the questions were, how do I say it? Like, they were vague enough, but specific enough as well. Like, do you like high skill ceiling games, like a Devil May Cry type deal or something? Mm-hmm. And I do, but it kind of allowed me to say, like, I do, but not, that's not all I play kind of deal.
I really appreciate that. We did a lot of work on making the questions, like, for gamers specifically who would understand it based off of their experiences. And, like, I think one, like, this was like, what, like the 7th or 10th iteration of that test. But I do really appreciate that, because, like, one of the key components to making sure that the criterias made sense was answering the questions as if it was like how you like to play, which means that you have to ask the question and then allow them to answer through like a strongly agree versus strongly disagree section. It has to make sense to them. I do appreciate that. So as we were going through all of that, so you're the Ascendiary, which means that a lot of the times when you're playing games, does it feel like there's like specific things that you're trying to achieve in the game? It's like, are you going after specific, like, are you a high, like, a completionist type of person?
So not necessarily completionist, although hyper specific. When I play a role-playing game that lets me discover a map, I always want to get 100% map discovery, but I'm not like an achievement hunter or, you know, I won't beat a game multiple times just to get a specific ending or whatever. But what I do go into it as sort of a skill benchmark I want to reach. So if I'm playing a stealth game, I want to ghost the room. And even if I get caught, and I'm able to, like, continue playing the game, I don't die, I will still restart the room. And people who watch me stream are very well aware of that, because I'll be playing Resident Evil and I'll leave the save room and fire two bullets too many that didn't hit the target. And I'm like, all right, that's a restart. So I do go into it with a very specific goal like that, but it's not necessarily completion. I just want to play the game in a way that feels like skillful or like I'm like,
you like
to
take on the challenge.
Cool. Yeah.
I feel like the more recent Resident Evil games really kind of steer into that direction as far as like multiple playthroughs, right? Because you'll get the higher difficulties, then there's certain unlockables for going through only using a knife or, you know, not ever saving or what have you.
And for me, it's not about the unlockable necessarily. It'd just be about like an RE3 on the PS1,
yeah,
killing the Gravedigger with just the knife.
Yeah,
I would be fine. That game never rewarded me for doing it.
But it's like just to do it is like...
Bragging rights?
Yes. You
know, that's the goal. That's
it's the personal achievement that you're looking for, the personal barriers that you have break.
Totally.
So what games are you, one, playing now? And then two, what games are you looking forward to?
Right now, me and the wife just started up Sea of Stars.
Oh my God, how good is it, dude?
I only got to play it for a few hours before we left, but it is so special.
I might have like 3 or 4 hours in it because we're trying to play it together. So when she's done with school and when I'm done with work, we get a chance to.
You guys are cute as fuck. Oh my God.
We try.
Yeah.
You know what? Honestly, what I want is I want to build a retro room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to have like 80s style furniture, a CRT. All the consoles that I have, they all feed into scalers and stuff, but they also feed into splitters.
Yeah.
And it's a full component setup, and I have a matrix component switch.
Oh,
so
wow.
I have two independent outputs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I could run component cables to this room,
okay,
plug them into a CRT, and have just native, you know, resolution, old school gaming. And we could sit there and watch VHS tapes from the 90s and play old SNES RPGs.
Oh, dude.
Like one night a week, twice a week, something like that, make a thing of it.
That's so cool.
So that's what we're working towards. But as it is right now, we'll settle for playing on a big LG OLED.
You must have so much room at your place.
Not
yet.
You would think, no.
Yeah.
No, we have a 3-bedroom house.
Okay.
But one of the bedrooms is where I work out of.
Mm.
It's like my office, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other bedroom we have is a literal guest bedroom because my friends and family...
coming to visit.
Yeah, part of the stipulation for us moving here is like, you guys have to come and visit. I'll come to the U.S. once a year, you come to Japan once a year, in that case I get to see everybody at some point.
That's awesome.
Oh, that's great.
That's awesome.
So we don't have room to do it in this place yet, and we're thinking maybe we might want to move, but our neighborhood's so picturesque. Like, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's like a Sam Rockwell? I think that's an actor. It's like one of those like typical Americana paintings, picket fence, and a kid with the overalls.
Norman. I was like, Sam
Rockwell's the actor.
Yeah.
It's like one of his paintings. It's like a Norman Rockwell, like Americana thing, but Japanese.
That's awesome.
Perfect,
that's...
beautiful residential neighborhood. Parents pushing the kids in the stroller.
Yeah,
everybody's walking their dogs. Very quiet. So maybe we won't move, just literally not to leave the
neighborhood. It sounds awesome.
It's funny. You said that before where you're like, you're quite literally living the dream. And everything that you're saying is living up to that.
It's so cool.
How are your neighbors? How are the community? What's that like?
So far, everybody kind of keeps to themselves, which is nice. Because me and my wife, that's typically how we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we lived in South Florida, we lived on a property with a few other houses. Our landlord owned all the houses on the property. There's like three of them. So it was kind of like a communal thing. Everybody hung out all the time. And they would always comment, like, oh, man, you guys are like antisocial. It's like, no. We love hanging out.
Yeah.
We're just doing our thing. Once a month, we'll see you. And it's like, it's dope. But so we are pretty kind of, we keep to ourselves for the most part. And hopefully we don't bother them too much with like loud music or watching movies late at night. But everybody's quiet. Everybody keeps themselves. People are very nice. Every once in a while, a package will be delivered to our neighbor and he'll come and bring it over to us. So it pretty much exactly how it was in the States. Everybody was there. I mean, you get looks.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, I skateboard to and from the station every
day. I saw that too. I was going
to
ask.
And so you tend to get looks, but it's like as a foreigner here, you're going to get it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, covered in tattoos, and, you know, looking the way that I do. I'm pretty used to it. So
there's so many tourists also in Tokyo. So I feel like everybody here is used to it specifically.
They're all here in like Shinokubo and Akihabara and stuff. Not as much in where I live.
Oh, I see. It's more residential.
Have you made a local friend group that you guys like hang out with?
Did you have friends here when you landed?
I do have, I have a few friends here. Really YouTuber friends.
Yeah.
Jimmy Hoppa, who runs Import Gaming for the Win, he lives in Sendai, which is like an hour or so away.
Okay.
Tikio Sam is a big like Tokyo J vlogger.
Tokyo J.
He's been here for like, God, I want to say 15 years. And me and him used to talk online years and years and years ago. And then we finally started hanging out when I moved here.
Awesome.
That might be it.
Okay.
Probably just two people. And just like kind of casual acquaintances. I didn't have any like hard, you know, friends I could come and live with or anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any schoolmates that you enjoy?
Yeah, for sure. Going to language school, man, it's a...
Dude, Do they give you
a wild variety of people, like Swedish people and this guy from Brazil I play fighting games with. And even living in South Florida, which is a really international area, you know, like my entire friend group is from like Chile and Mexico and Italy and stuff. But here specifically, man, it's like people from like France. I have their numbers and it's like just a huge wide swath of different types of people.
You're living the international dream. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's super fun.
God.
Yeah. I didn't think about it before I came because I was like, yeah, we're going to school. And then my concept of school is like going to school in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you show up and it's like people are from everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All of them speak really good English, which really
makes
you aware of like, there are people out there who they're struggling with Japanese and it's their fourth language because maybe they live in like, you know, maybe they're French Canadian. They speak, you know, French, English, and now they're struggling with Japanese. And here I am, just like,
I only know.
Well, this is exactly the feeling that we had when we were coming, or at least that I did, where I'm like, oh, you know, I think it'll be fine because people will speak English. And it's like, what a weird, like, awful perspective to have, where it's like they'll speak my language. It's fine.
And what's
it's
insane is you were right.
It's a weird thing.
It is very odd. It makes you feel almost like bad, like, oh, you didn't have to do that for me.
They're stepping in for you. Do you wear a uniform when you go to school?
No, sadly, I wish. So
I
watch a lot of like Yankee media, which is like a Japanese high school
like anime stuff?
Slice of life.
Slice of life.
It's more like rebellious teenage youth, like people fist fighting in the streets kind of stuff.
Okay.
Like,
nice. The opposite.
man, they're so hard to explain. So there's this series called Crows. It's this high school where when you're just a terrible kid and the state wants you to be somewhere, you go to this school.
Okay.
And the whole point of the school is you have to be the biggest badass. And you have to just beat everybody.
Like jail?
It's essentially like jail. Prison? But getting to the top is the goal. And nobody ever gets to the top because everybody's always trying. And every year you have a freshman who's rising up the ranks. And by third year, they're strong enough to take you down, right? Like, it's such a cool concept.
What's the game I'm thinking of? River City Ransom?
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. Yeah. Totally.
That's Yankee Media. Yeah. The Kunio-kun series.
Yeah.
So like that's what I'm super into. So I was kind of hoping I would be able to wear a uniform that I could
fight somebody in.
Pop the collars.
So they have, it's called a Gakudan.
Okay.
And I'm like, if I had a Gakudan, I would make it look so Yankee.
Yeah.
I have my fingers crossed, but sadly,
you should
no.
just do it, man. Oh, you should so just cool. be that person.
I really want
people
to.
People would appreciate it.
So here's the weird thing, though. As an adult, I don't want to ask anybody, hey, where can I buy a school uniform?
Yeah.
You know, just looks. Randomly. You know. Also, I'm huge, so there's no way it would fit me.
Yeah.
You'd have to get it custom made. It's funny because, like, as we're walking around, like, I'm pretty tall, too, but I have noticed that I also can't buy clothes here. Like, how do you get clothes?
So with like t-shirts, it's got to be like a double XL.
Yeah.
For which is just a little smaller than XL in the States.
Okay.
And for shoes, surprisingly, I didn't have any issues.
I was going to say, we were walking around Harajuku yesterday, and it seems like, I mean, there's like this whole section that's all streetwear and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we're like, it's all the stuff that we can find in New York, you know?
So that whole Harajuku, cool. Shibuya area is where I go to buy shoes and fitness stuff.
Especially in some of the places like Shinjuku, they're so fashionable. Everybody's so freaking fashionable here.
Yeah. It depends on where you go, because that's what I like about my neighborhood, too, is everybody's walking around like pajama pants.
Nice. That's my style. That's
They're all 5 minutes away from their house, because we have a 7-Eleven right there in the neighborhood. Yeah. So, you know, people are popping up there in their underwear, you know, just to get a drink. It's great. I love it. If you're in like Shibuya or Harajuku, you'll notice the fashion change between like where I live in Nakano, where things are a little more laid back. And there's more of like in Shibuya, there's an area with like a hardcore and punk rock scene.
Cool.
And then you can transition from everybody wearing the latest fashions and the nicest dresses to like dudes in leather jackets and tattoos.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Dude, all representation here in Tokyo. That's sick.
That's the cool thing I didn't think about before I came here is because everything's so compressed, the city's so small relatively compared to the amount of people
dense.
In it.
Yeah.
If you have a niche hobby or something, there's a lot of people around you that you could meet up with, like fighting games or whatever it is.
Yeah.
If you get into like small electronic soldering, there's a lot of people you can hang out with and do it with. So
that's awesome.
The disparate little cliques are way easier to find here because everybody's in such a small area that you're going to happen past them, you know?
Yeah.
It's pretty dope.
That is really cool.
Have you been able to find, like, what kind of groups have you infiltrated?
You know, I don't hang out with a lot of Japanese people regularly.
Yeah.
Christ, what is he? I think he's Syrian. He runs the kebab shop in my neighborhood. I talk to him all the time, but, oh no, he's Turkish, and I don't speak Turkish, so we have to speak in Japanese, so that
almost counts. That's interesting.
It almost counts. Yeah, but I talk to him a lot, because every time I go to eat there, we just have a conversation. And then I know the guy at my local it's basically restaurants.
Yeah, yeah, right.
If you run a restaurant in my neighborhood, we hung out and
I know you. how comfortable are you sitting on your knees now?
I never do it.
No?
I don't eat a lot of traditional, like, izakayas or anything like that. So for the most part, it's like a setup, like Western-style dining. And stuff. Okay.
There's one time where... the first time I came to Japan was in 2013. I was here for, like, 3 weeks. But my friend, Summer, shout out to Summer, she was living in Fukuoka at the time in the JET program. She had lived here for, like, 5 years.
Yeah.
And she had, like, a host family that she knew from way back when, which we went to visit. And then so I had, like, the traditional Japanese, like, experience where they sit in, like, in the ground with the cutout for your feet.
That's so cool.
It's so cool. And it was like winter time too, so we had like the blanket over us and
kotatsu, hell yeah.
But then
yeah.
we would have dinners where it was you're supposed to sit, like, you could sit cross-legged. I'm like, no, I'm gonna sit on my knees, and it hurts. It hurts real bad.
I have a weird thing with, I don't know if you could see it. You see this?
I can see that. What is that? What is sticking out of your shit right now?
It's called a something Schlatter disease. It's like a weird thing that forms where your kneecap and your shin bone kind of come into contact.
Okay. Oh, so you just like can't then.
I have awful knees. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah, if I had to kneel onto this, there'd be an issue.
Yeah, you're still fearlessly skateboard around in Tokyo.
How do you think I got this?
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, my knees are shot. But I used to play football in high school and do high school wrestling and stuff. So I was always kind of involved in physical things.
That's so cool.
I'm genetically predisposed to having bad knees on my mom's side of the family. So it was just kind of...
But your mentality is like, screw that. I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah, I have a very interesting catchphrase. It's like, I don't let my body tell me what my body's going to do. My mind controls everything my body does.
Yeah. My ego writes the checks.
I mean, I'm about to turn 40 and I'm still, you know, going to the skate park. So
You're about to turn 40? Dude, didn't think that at all.
Well, that's good.
23.
Maybe it's not that. I swear, like, we were at a Golden Guy the other night, and we're sitting across from this bartender. It's like cool dude.
Shoto.
And we're just chatting with him and stuff. And we were specifically trying to go into some of these bars that had Shota.
Shota.
We were specifically trying to go to bars that had like younger bartenders, just because it was, I don't know, just kind of a cool vibe.
Yeah.
And in the middle of it, he's like, oh yeah, I'm about to turn like 50. We're like, what? Like, you look like you're 25.
The
like,
food in Japan is just so much.
I was going to say, something about Japan. It's keeping everybody young.
The ingredients.
Japan, what is they called? They call it like a blue zone or something, where people live to 100 more often.
Yeah.
Whoa.
It's not Japan. It's Okinawa.
Down
south.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's like there's a blue zone where everybody lives to at least like 95 or something ridiculous.
All other countries need to learn from that place.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Dang.
So I'll steer into it just briefly. It's not my expertise at all, but I'm just curious about it. So as we're walking around, I do see that skate culture is like pretty predominant around here. And you're saying you're going to skate parks and stuff like... Yeah. That this was something that you brought with you from Florida, and you're just kind of like acclimating. Like, are you accepted by the skating like crew?
I haven't. I've skated with a lot of foreigners because I met them through school.
Okay. Mm.
But when I go like to the skate park and stuff, I mean, people are pretty. It's the same as being in a skate park in America, essentially. If you land something dope, people, you know,
people are down.
It's dope. There's no difference. You being a foreigner, when you walk in, you're definitely going to get the side eye.
Yeah.
But it's not from like any kind of a negative sense. It's just like,
I've
seen maybe four guys like this in my entire life.
Gotcha.
I mean, you really have to consider it's I think it's 97% Japanese in this country.
Yeah.
So when people see a foreigner, a lot of people who live here can get frustrated Because it's like, yeah, the eyes are always on me and stuff. It's like, dude, you are not even part of the 1%.
Yeah.
It's very strange to see you.
You know what's crazy? I feel like it has to be more like swinging in this direction now, because I feel like because of COVID and everything, tourism was probably like came down crazily because they had all the restrictions and stuff. Mm. But now it seems like all of our friends that are local to us in like the New York area, like three, maybe four of our groups of friends have all planned trips to Japan within the same like 3 weeks.
Since the restrictions got lifted, this place has blown up.
Yeah. So like literally next week, I don't know if you know Bob Wolf from Wolf Den Media, is another YouTuber.
Yeah.
So he's coming with like a bunch of our friends literally.
Oh yeah, he's friends with Wood, right?
Yeah.
So Wood's coming too. So he and Wood.
No way! I got to message him.
Yeah. So they're coming in on
that
the 19th.
Way back in the day, like 10 years ago, when he had like
actually
like 5,000 subscribers. Me and him used to talk.
Actually, if you're down on the 19th, so this is, I'm blowing up our plans. But on the 19th, I have a giant like 10-person reservation, and we're gonna meet them for dinner when they get here.
You and your wife should
right
do
around
the
here.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Do you know? Do you know the podcast Sacred Symbols? It's a podcast with Colin Moriarty. So,
Colin Moriarty.
So the executive producer of that podcast, his name is Dustin Furman. He's coming too. So yeah, he's coming in the same time frame. So I was like, you want to come to this dinner with Bob and whatever? And they're like, yeah. So we're like, okay.
I'm trying to figure it out.
Yeah. That'd be super cool.
Dude, absolutely. You have my number now.
Yeah. The non-YouTubers are making a YouTuber hangout.
What's happening right now?
I don't network enough, man.
Yeah.
For the YouTube thing. A lot of people, it's like, you know, making contacts. Mm-hmm. It's like very business-like, but getting into YouTube for me, it was always like a creative pursuit thing.
Yeah.
Fair, and that's what it should be.
Yeah, and that's what I try my hardest not to...
get wrapped up
over business.
Yeah,
if I it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it is very important that I'm able to pay, you know, the bills at the end of the month, and I do need to, at the very least, orient myself towards that. But
yeah,
I try not to let that kind of influence what I do creatively at all.
I will say that you should like, not should. Should is a strong word. I would say whatever feels right, especially on the creative side. Just keep doing that.
Yeah.
That's what matters.
Yeah, and I wanted to say, like, and I'm not trying to like gas you up or anything, but like, and this is for our listeners too, it's more of a sales pitch. But the type of content that you make, it's clear that you're very passionate about the types of games that you cover and the types of genres that you're really sort of like entrenched in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're looking for that type of stuff, like I know I was in that market, right? That's how I found you in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this guy gets it. Like he's in this space, he's played all the stuff, like you've got all the context, and it's the type of thing where when you're speaking about a game, it's not like, it doesn't feel like a pitch. You're talking from like I'm literally actually playing these games, and this is the type of stuff that I like, and I want a way to talk about it, and that's kind of what it feels like, you know?
Hell yeah. I mean, that's truly what I go for. The idea is, when watching the content, you get an idea for how passionate I am about it.
Yeah.
And even if I'm criticizing it, or I'm like, man, you know, it drops down to 30 frames per second, and has a double buffer V-Sync or something.
Yeah.
Even when I'm, the little micro complaints that I have, or like if the scaling doesn't work well or whatever it is, I want it to come through. It's like, yeah, but this is something I really get into.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm mentioning it.
Yeah. I've been, most recently I've watched a lot of your, sort of like compilations, like games like Resident Evil games and what have you.
Yeah.
And I actually picked up a couple from there. Vampire Hunter D sounded particularly cool. Is that really good?
It's mega fun. It's also mega frustrating.
Okay.
It has a very weird design to it, but it really does just feel like you're controlling D and playing a survival horror game. It's really cool.
Yeah. And then I've also been interested, and I haven't heard your opinion on this yet, this game Signalis. Have you played that?
Play Signalis, please.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. I've heard that some of the puzzles are like a little cryptic, like not really intuitive to solve them and things like that.
I don't think they are. I don't find them to be. So when I beat it, it was before it was released.
Okay.
So I didn't have a strategy guide, and I was able to beat the game in roundabout the average clear time.
Okay.
So I would imagine if you're used to survival horror games, survival horror game puzzles in particular, you'll probably do okay. It doesn't really suffer from like adventure game logic where it's like, oh yeah, you get the stick and the turtle and you put them together and obviously that's how you, it's relatively intuitive. Like, listen to the radio at this frequency in order to get, a song to play that a recorder will unlock the door or something.
Gotcha.
You know,
okay.
It's not terrible. Some of the puzzles will have you kind of thinking to solve them, but it kind of feels like how you should be. Mm-hmm. You know, the puzzle is meant to have you.
It's logical.
Gotcha.
The inferences are,
But yeah, I mean, if I was able to do it, and I'm not exactly the smartest guy in the world, I feel like probably most people shouldn't have too many issues.
For context, Signalis is a it's a aesthetic very like very much like a PS1 style kind of thing, survival horror, space adventure,
like
sort of
low
thing.
Poly. It's like a 2001: A Space Odyssey meets Silent Hill from a top down sort of isometric perspective.
Yeah.
Very good stuff.
Thank you for explaining that. I have no idea what Exodus is.
Oh, it's so good. The soundtrack is to die.
It's coming out on vinyl now.
Really?
I think it's dropping this weekend.
It's very good.
Are you into vinyl at all? Or?
My wife wants to be.
Yeah.
Recently, she's really wanted to. And I could see myself building like a stereo hi-fi system.
Yeah.
And that'd be cool.
Okay.
Especially here in Tokyo, there's a lot of secondhand shops. And all of them have like, you know, surround sound receivers, old turntables, and big like... massive floor standing speakers.
Yeah.
So I could probably get it done here pretty cheap.
Dude, the hi-fi stuff all comes from Japan. I mean, really good stuff.
It's a conversation that we'll have later, but I'm going to send you some stuff.
Okay. All right. Hell yeah.
It's funny though, because as we're going around, I definitely haven't seen any vinyl representation in Tokyo.
Well,
so
we passed by Tower Records.
That's right. All right. You're true.
If you get into like underground music, like hardcore, punk rock, emo, and stuff like
definitely,
that.
100%.
Nerd Records in Shibuya. Amazing.
Okay.
A lot of vinyl there.
Okay.
Also, like, a lot of, like, underground, like, t-shirts from, like, My Chemical Romance.
Like, Japanese bands or, like, everywhere?
Everything.
Awesome. Dear and Grey.
Yeah. Like, German, you know, punk rock bands. There's some hip-hop there as well.
Okay. I don't think Dear and Grey released anything on vinyl. Maybe, like, two albums.
Dear and Grey is super cool.
Yeah. Not many people know them. I was a massive, massive Dear and Grey fan. I followed them on tour for like many years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's cool. I was like very, very into them. That was like pre-Marrow. It was like during Withering to Death, and then when Marrow came out, I followed them for like basically like three albums worth of their
run. Is it Dear and Grey that do Beast of Blood?
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah. That's sick.
I love that.
Justin teaches me all about this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, man.
There's not, you know, what's very interesting, not a lot of Japanese people that you'll stop on the street and talk to listen to Japanese music very much.
Really?
Or they won't admit it?
No. Like, my teachers are all Japanese, and I'll talk to them. And I used to have a tutor in the U.S. briefly before I came here just to brush up.
Mm.
And I asked them all the same question because I listen to a lot of J-pop, a lot of Japanese, like, you know, really popular stuff that, like, upbeat kind of electronic stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I always ask for recommendations from my teachers and tutors. And I mean, for the most part, all of them go like, Japanese bands, huh? Oh, yeah, I can't. I don't think I listen to a lot. I swear to you.
What do they listen to?
So like one of my teachers, shout out to Naito Sensei at Kai Nihongo School. she's heavy into like DJ Tiesto and like club and
like ultra and all that
stuff like
techno
that.
Electronic. That's
so I was like, okay, word. And I was like, any Japanese, like trance or techno? And she's like, oh no, yeah, just all European stuff. And
really?
Even, you know,
does
the
Steve
metal
Aoki heads. Count? Like,
that's a very good question. I have to learn the lines. Yeah, I mean, the same in Golden Guy, there's a heavy metal bar called Deathmatch in Hell.
Oh yeah, I saw that place. So
it's great. Go in there. It's
really?
Super fun.
Yeah.
He has the whole bar countertop is just old VHS, like Italian zombie movies and horror flicks.
Really?
And he has a little CRT. He's always playing an old like 80s slasher or something.
Yo, that's so
awesome.
Cool.
Very cool.
There's places like that in Brooklyn. I love that.
He's
that's
a very
amazing.
Nice guy, the guy that runs the bar, and he's making money hand over fist because the restrictions let up and everybody goes there.
Yeah.
And he's always complaining to me and my buddy about like, I can't work this much anymore. I'm always working. And then we're like, well, just hire somebody. He's like, no, I don't care that much. I just don't want people to come in.
Yeah.
Because
he
makes enough money to buy old horror movies and listen to like heavy metal records.
Yeah.
That's all he wants to do.
He's just trying to hang out, but he's got people knocking on the door.
Literally, that's it.
Can we hang out?
He's doing such a good job. And he's like, I don't want the success. So stop it.
Yeah, Deathmatch in Hell is very cool.
Very cool. Highly recommended. Yeah. We were making the rounds. We'll probably be by there either tonight or on our second leg in Tokyo.
It blows my mind that, I mean, okay, so what's your run-in with, like, the idol situations or, like, baby metal when that started becoming a thing? Like, have you run into any of this?
Not, like, physically here since I've been in the country. A lot of the idol stuff is kind of very low-key. A lot of it's in Akihabara. And you have very small venues in a room this size with a very low stage. Mm-hmm. And it's a very niche sort of circle.
Really?
Like you have an idol group that has like a single out, you know, not a record or anything. But you go to see them and they'll perform that one song, that single. You go there with the glow sticks.
Yeah, right.
Is the hope that they like just blow up like crazy off of it?
I think that's what it is. So you start small and you're like, yeah, this idol group. And then when they blow up, you're like, yeah, I was there from the start.
Gotcha. Okay.
But it's that, but it's a very, very otaku, very socially awkward
scene.
Yeah, you know?
But with the baby metal thing, I remember I didn't see them personally. But I remember when I was in Japan visiting, them being really big in sort of like underground YouTube, kind of like these idol groups are blowing up type of YouTube channels. Mm-hmm. And then they ended up being like the biggest thing in the world. And we ended up seeing them in Florida, like a huge arena that like Slayer played. So it's a massive venue and they just have it packed to the brim.
That whole, like, I don't know, I guess that genre seems like it's picking up even more because isn't like Blackpink in the same, like, you know,
and then
the
there's thing? Also Ladybeard, I think was their name. It's a very similar style. There's also Maid Band. A lot of them is cropping up.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, they essentially, a lot of the people who like manage these idol groups and stuff, they're just regular, and you know, just by happenstance, some of them would have to listen to metal.
Yeah, yeah.
And heavy metal has been really becoming a part of the mainstream here in Japanese music.
Really?
Interesting.
Like
visual kei music. Yeah. That's doing great, yeah.
Yeah.
That stuff has become essentially death metal.
Yeah.
Like really and truly, if you listen to visual kei bands that are really big right now, they have blast beats, they have death metal vocals.
Yeah.
It is 100% death metal, and it's being played on the radio for normal people.
See, that's so weird. Interesting. Like, when I was first listening to this kind of stuff, I was like, nobody's ever gonna find this. Like, it's just like the most sort of like
niche.
You get like, you know, people know like X Japan and stuff like that, and it's like that's kind of its own thing. Mm-hmm. But once you started getting like a little bit more like concentrated, like what was the guy's name in Dirge of Cerberus? The dude at the end.
Gackt,
yes. Like, he was probably the most popular in that world for a while. But, like, all of those, like, smaller ones, I felt like it wasn't, you know, they were just kind of, like, you had to be, like, looking for it to find it kind of thing.
Gackt.
Well, that's how it started. And then I think through, like, nerd culture and, you know, being into, like, Japanese stuff in the States.
Yeah.
It's a small scene and everybody talks.
Yeah.
And I think through that, it started. And then, what, if you have a sister and you're listening to Dorian Gray all the time and she ends up getting into it and it's like, you could track the spread of the virus.
Yeah. Oh, that's crazy.
Dude, the culture, it's fascinating to hear it from somebody else because, like, in the States, the culture that I'm seeing both in video games and in music is very from, like, the outside looking in. But hearing it from somebody who's, like, living on the floor here in Japan and then seeing, like, it all kind of, like, gestate is way different. And it's fascinating to me that Japanese people don't listen to Japanese music.
Yeah.
It's blowing my mind a little bit.
A lot of the people, it's a lot of young people too, because a lot of the music that gets shipped here, a lot of the culture is sort of based off of American pop culture, fashion and stuff like that. I mean, obviously, there's a Japanese twist to it by the time it gets here. But yeah, with music, I mean, if you're walking through Shinjuku and they have those big TVs with the advertisements on it, it's like Tina Turner, Michael Jackson. You know what I mean?
Really?
Like,
I was hearing a lot of Bruno Mars.
Yeah, exactly. This is true. Exactly. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And when you eat at a restaurant, it's a coin flip, 50-50. It's either like American R&B or like Japanese jazz music. We went, it's one or the other.
Just yesterday, we went to the Kill Bill restaurant. I forgot what that was called.
I couldn't even tell you.
But either way, it's the one where, you know, the mace, the schoolgirl with the mace and, you know,
Crazy 88 fight.
Yes, exactly. But the music that they were playing there was not at all Japanese. In fact, it was exactly like more R&B, like almost like Rastafarian stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Gompachi Nishi Azabu.
There you go.
That's the
excellent.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of places you'll see they will play at least Western music, you know, some, you know, British tunes.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's not a lot of Japanese people that go out of their way to listen to strictly Japanese music unless they're older.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people like the traditional sound of like Enka or like very traditional Japanese music. People who listen to like the shamisen and stuff.
Yeah, the classical stuff.
But for the most part, as far as like, you know, your 35, 40 year olds and down.
Yeah.
Man, they're all listening to whatever's on the radios where you're from.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Okay, so I'll steer us back into games one more time. So we've been going for about an hour so far, so we'll start finding our
landing pads. It's been a good conversation. Soon.
But you were saying that the game that you're playing right now is Sea of Stars. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of like your primary thing? Because I know you say you also stream, so like what's kind of like pulling your attention right now?
Right now, I am playing Sea of Stars, and so here, when I'm doing the YouTube stuff, I have the game that I'm playing that I'm working on, and then I have the game that I'm like playing with my wife or whatever, and then I have what I play on the side to relax from, you know, I'm sick and tired of playing Resident Evil Remake right now. That's what I'm covering right now. I'm trying to put a video together, like all the ports of Resident Evil Remake and Resident Evil Remake Remaster.
Yeah.
How do they compare and stuff? So that's
GameCube versus PS4?
GameCube versus PS4. There's a Wii version.
The Wii one.
Archives, right?
The PS4 version specifically, the CG cutscenes are compressed in a way that causes weird color information to be messed up.
I need this detail so that my conversations become more interesting.
Exactly. But so I have sort of three games that I'm playing at any one time.
Yeah.
And right now I'm doing the Resident Evil Remake. Me and Jocelyn are playing Sea of Stars. And in between, I've been messing around with Nocturne.
Okay.
The remaster on Steam.
Yeah. That was like completely not on my radar. Is it good so far?
Super good, yeah. It's a really good remaster. A lot of the PS2 games are so easy to remaster because they had enough pixels and polygons to work with to smooth things out.
Oh, the Shin Megami Tensei. That came out a while ago, right? Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
It's one with Dante in it.
Yes. Well, the remaster no longer has Dante.
What? Aw.
Dante was in that game?
In the PS2 version of Shin Megami Tensei 3.
He was in the US release. In the Japanese release, it was Raido, I forget his last name, but he's from another Shin Megami Tensei series,
Digital Devil Saga?
No, it's not Devil Summoner. I forget it.
Okay.
But whoever's listening to this podcast will be very upset that I don't remember it.
They will.
The SMT fan base is very hardcore, but I'm with you guys. I just don't remember.
I'm one of you, I swear.
I believe it is Devil Summoner, maybe. But anyways, it's a guy from another Shin Megami Tensei property.
Okay.
And they swapped his character model and his dialogue to Dante for the US release.
That's awesome. I love those things. I remember when that was out on the PS2. That was like the main. Yeah. I had not played any Shin Megami Tensei before that. I was like, but I know that guy, so I'll play that game.
It's a really cool game, and the remaster is really good. They added voice acting where there wasn't any before, which is kind of cool.
Very cool. Yeah. Very cool.
Isn't so Dante? That's Capcom, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then isn't Shin Megami Tensei? Isn't that
Atlas?
Yes. Oh. I have no idea how that deal got worked out.
Yeah.
Zero idea whatsoever. maybe Capcom published it in the States.
Yeah.
Because sometimes Atlas will develop a game that someone else publishes, or vice versa.
There you go.
That probably makes sense.
Yeah.
That's what I'll tell people.
Yeah. Here's the next thing. What games are you looking forward to right now? And I need to get your hot or cold on this Silent Hill 2 remake.
You know, I feel like it's more of a lukewarm take. For Silent Hill 2 remake, I am looking forward to it. And I bet you $10 is going to be a really competent, really atmospheric horror game. It's probably not going to be Silent Hill 2.
Yeah, I hear that. You think the bloopers got it, though? Did you play the medium?
I did, and I actually liked the medium.
What?
Yeah, a lot of people hated it.
Justin did not like it.
I really liked it.
I was appalled by that game.
So when I went into the medium, I didn't know. People had hyped it up as this survival horror revival at the time, and I wasn't aware of that. I went into it thinking it was going to be like an adventure game.
Makes sense now.
So, as I'm playing it, I'm like, this is 100% living up to my expectations. Yeah.
I was like, oh, this is going to be a game with combat. No, it's not.
Yeah. There's zero combat in it. It's mostly puzzle solving.
It has this great puzzle where you just drag a knife down a wall, and that's it. That's the puzzle. And you know how many times that's in the game? Like 6 times.
Yeah. But the thing is you have to, like, the puzzle is finding the knife that cuts it. You know, for what it was, that's exactly what I was expecting.
Yeah.
But I get the impression a lot of people, because even I think even Bloober Team might have played into the whole survival horror thing.
Well, that's what I mean. That's how it was billed as, at least, you know, from my perspective. I was like, they're clearly trying to get some sort of Silent Hill energy going with this and all this kind of stuff. And then to introduce combat at the 11th hour, at the very end of the game, and it's one button, and it's terrible. Yeah. It's like, this is, like, not doing it, man.
No, and that first chase scene where you, like, come across that demon, and, like, he's chasing after you, and there's no clear indication where you should go, and I died, like, six times. It's very frustrating, but I also get super frustrated by survival horror and adventure games as well. But I had that same experience with The Evil Within.
Okay.
That was billed to me as the return of survival horror. Shinji Mikami's back.
Yep.
And I played it, and I was like, no, this is like an okay enough horror game, but I mean, it's obviously not survival horror, you know?
Did you finish the second one?
No, I didn't finish the first one.
Okay.
I kind of hated it.
Yeah.
And everybody tells me you have to play the second one, so I'm trying to work a video out right now where it's like, I hated the first, but here's the second, or, you know, something like that.
The second one does more, but I also did not finish it. I beat the first game begrudgingly. I kind of played that because, again, I was like, there must be something here that I'm missing, right? And then halfway through the second one, I was like, okay, I just couldn't with it anymore because they turned it into an open world game.
Yeah.
And it's more of a stealth game than a horror game. Mm. So it's like, it's got some weird
energy. I feel like I would probably enjoy playing that more, like, mechanically. Whereas, you know, a lot of, for me, survival horror, the stuff that I deal with most is just about playing a game that I'm already familiar with and the zen-like experience of running through the RPD and going, oh, that's right, the diamond key. I forgot the diamond key. Those little moments where you remember a game that you've played 10,000 times before is what I search for when I play those type of games.
It's a nostalgia trip that you're going for.
It's... It's so hard to explain. I don't know. When I play RE2, I'm immediately transported to a very specific moment, not even the first time I played it, but a very specific moment when I was in Alabama staying with a family. My mom was visiting her family, and there's the room that all the kids hung out in, and my mom's going to like a video rental place, which dates this story very well. And she's like, okay, I'm going to this rental place. They have some video games. What should I get you? And your mom doesn't know anything about game genres or whatever. If it was a PS1 game, we were lucky that she had the right console.
Yeah.
So I was like, look for, you know, Resident Evil. That's a series I like. Any Resident Evil game would be fine.
Yeah.
And I rented Resident Evil 2, and I played through RE2 probably four times in a row because it's such a quick beat.
Oh, yeah.
And I was listening to the entire time the album Let's Face It by Mighty Mighty Bosstones.
Oh, my gosh, that's amazing.
So every time I play RE2, I'm immediately transported back to that moment.
Yeah.
And every survival horror game has one of those moments for me.
Yeah.
And those are the moments I'm chasing when I play them.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So I just kind of like sit back. You have like, it's like wearing a comfy sweater.
Yeah.
Back in that familiar moment.
It's
that's
so
awesome.
It's
beautiful.
Funny. I so jive with this. Like, similar. So Resident Evil 2 is actually the first Resident Evil game I played. And like, I have an older brother, right? So at the time he was like over a friend's house who had the PlayStation version, but we didn't have a PlayStation at the time. So we got the N64 version for Christmas. And it was like, you know, I'm like, I don't even know how old at that time. It's 96, so I was like, you know, eight or something like
eight,
that.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there with my brother, and we're playing through this game, and I just remember Christmas Day, we're playing through this, and just absolutely pissing my pants when it was like the two-way mirror liquor room. Oh my, like, yeah, it absolutely like ruined me, but like, that's such a core, like, memory of that game. And because it's such a short playthrough, it's like you can kind of like recapture that like momentary nostalgia in such a like digestible thing.
Oh, for sure.
Whereas like if you go back and play like an RPG, you'll get those feelings, but you're in it for 60 hours, you know? So it's a little bit harder.
All those moments are spread out across a longer land or wider landscape.
Totally.
With survival horror, you sit down 2 hours later, you're like, well, I'm done with that. That was sick.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. So yeah. So what outside of Silent Hill 2? I'm very skeptical of the Silent Hill 2 remake. That trailer didn't do it for me. I was like, they got some weird filter going on, or it's like too high def or something. It's not atmosphere-y enough, you know? Do you know what I mean? Like,
everything that I've watched on the Silent Hill 2 trailer, like debriefs and breakdowns, is the idea behind, like, they're just not getting the mystery as much. So it's like everything is the too high def part. You could see too much. It's not too hazy. It's not hazy enough. When people were talking about like Silent Hill 2 back in the day, they were like constrained by the system and the console and the hardware, so they had to build things in that made it way more atmospheric.
You know, so interestingly, a lot of people have the wrong idea about Silent Hills 2 and 3, where this idea that it's like constrained by the hardware. There's not a port of Silent Hill 2 or 3 that is able to replicate the specific things going on the PS2.
Really?
Like, for example, Silent Hill 2 on the Xbox runs kind of shitty.
Yeah.
There's momentary stutters. They're intermittent. It's like a sawtooth. So it happens here and then here.
Interesting.
And it's just, I think it's two-frame stutters.
But it loads way faster, right? If I'm remembering correctly.
Loading... Okay, so it does technically, but it's RAM speed differences. Mm. But for example, they can't fill the screen with as much fog on Xbox. There's noticeably less because the game would slow down on Xbox with that much fog being used. The PS2's architecture was so hyper-specific that you couldn't pull off certain things on the Xbox that you could on PS2 unless you affected the frame rate.
Mm-hmm.
PS2 had like an amazing amount of throughput, and the way that its frame buffer worked was kind of different from everything else, to where like early dev kits for the console, you had to achieve 60 fields per second or else like video output wasn't possible.
Yeah.
So what you're telling me is that the PlayStation 2, it's not about the limitations, rather it's about the capabilities that the PS2 had versus...
The quirks
of that
console.
It was hyper-specific. It was... So you had to be very skilled to work on the PS2. It was the same way the Sega Saturn was.
Hmm.
You had to really understand the Saturn to develop a game for it because of the weird architecture. The PS2 is the very same, and I think it was probably the most capable console of its day in practice, as far as its specs and internal stuff goes. That doesn't play out, obviously. The GameCube beats it in a lot of ways. But because of how hyper-specific it is, where you could only do PS2 things on the PS2, I feel like it bumps it up a little bit more than most people are familiar with.
Yeah.
But I feel where you guys are coming from with the Silent Hill 2 thing. And because I know that it won't be a Silent Hill 2, you know, the Silent Hill 2 that I know.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot of expectation, or a lot, I'm not holding it to a very high standard.
It's so a different game.
For me, it just has to be a good horror game.
Yes.
And what I see when I saw the trailer, it wasn't Silent Hill to me. You know, I didn't see them accurately representing Silent Hill, but I did see a horror game with a lot of details and the grass blowing and the way James's like jacket moves. That would be the thing that I would go into expecting in a horror game.
Mm.
If I expected this to be a genuine Silent Hill game,
very
different set of expectations.
Yeah,
true. Yeah.
And like, so maybe that's it, the perspective and the angle that you're coming in from.
It's all framing.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. If you want a Silent Hill game, I doubt very much you're going to be happy with what you get in the Silent Hill 2 remake. But if you're looking for a horror game that's probably going to tinge on the more psychological front, I couldn't imagine them screwing it up too bad.
I see.
From a video game perspective. From a Silent Hill perspective, they lost before they started.
It's an unwinnable fight.
The problem is, it's more easily winnable than you might think, but you have to go into Silent Hill with the right approach. A lot of people assume Silent Hill is just, it's 100% up to interpretation. You can't make a video game out of up to interpretation because my interpretation is not going to jive well with yours if I'm playing your game.
Right? Yeah. But I think so much of it is like atmosphere, right? It's the way the game is supposed to make you feel, right? Not specifically like doing certain things. Like if it does it fog in this way, then it's Silent Hill. It's more like, does the game make me feel like this sort of, you know, uncomfortable, like, where am I? What exactly am I
all
doing?
All the ingredients
like,
in the stew.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And I feel like there are definitely games that achieve that. I mean, what we saw with the PT demo, I think, pushed in that direction as hard as you could possibly go, which is why I think it was so revered.
Mm.
But, you know, I feel like the pieces are there, but it's like, how do you assemble them in the right way?
I think the problem that most people run into is they try to make a modern game that's Silent Hill, and you can't make a modern game that's Silent Hill.
Mm.
Right.
For example, Bloober Team is adding in, like, dodge cancels and dodge rolls and stuff.
Yes.
And I'm like, in a game, that's an awesome thing to have. And a lot of people's arguments are like, yeah, there's dodge rolls in all kinds of games. I don't think making a game play bad is necessarily beneficial.
Yeah.
It's not about having it play bad. The focus in Silent Hill 2 was not the combat.
Yeah.
And combat in Silent Hill 2 functioned perfectly well. I could play through that game right now on this TV and never die.
Yeah.
You know, I'm only limited by the amount of time I have to sit here.
Yeah, so there's like two things here, right? So it's both the modernization of like gameplay mechanics, mm-hmm. and then there's modernization used like as technology and capabilities mm-hmm. for an experience that you're trying to have, right? Yeah. So, and I definitely understand from some of the older horror games. I mean, I'm not a big horror buff, mm-hmm. especially not like you guys, but mm-hmm. from the horror games back then to now, like some of the scary elements in that game was just how poor the controls were, you know?
I think the thought is that it's bad controls, but it's
not bad, but like
I would say that that was kind of an unintended consequence of like things like tank controls. A lot of people with the YouTube video essay sort of explosion, people have started to think really deeply about really not deep things, mm-hmm. like tank controls. It's like, yeah, Capcom was trying to ensure that you couldn't get away from the enemies as well as you wanted to, which is not true at all.
Yeah, yeah.
What they did was they used tank controls because that's almost the only way you can control a fixed perspective video game.
Yeah. On PS1 with no analog sticks and D-pad.
They literally could not do anything else. I mean, the game that they were essentially building their blueprints from, Alone in the Dark, had tank controls.
Yeah.
Because tank controls were a PC thing for a very long time. A lot of PC adventure games that allowed full control of your character had them. So it had nothing to do.
But does the intentionality take away from the overall experience and the results?
Probably not. But because my experience is that tank controls are so intuitive that I've never struggled with them. Yeah. Never had that effect on me. So it's something that I have to take people's word on.
But if you were to play Resident Evil 2, mm-hmm. right, and there's dodge rolls, would it be the same game?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think it would make the combat such a heavy focus.
Yeah.
Because once you have the dodge roll, you're probably going to want to put the player in scenarios where he'd have to engage in combat and utilize the dodge roll more often.
We're talking about Resident Evil 6 now.
Which changes the entire format of the game. Making a small change like that. And I think a lot of people, I made a comment about it on Twitter. You know, the Silent Hill 2 dodge roll, because that's what we want in a Silent Hill game, right? And everybody took a very simplistic positions, like, it's a dodge roll, who cares? And I'm like, the very smallest change you make at a foundational level on the top floor ends up being hundreds of feet worth of difference.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this is why, and I just to draw a comparison, this is why I think, like, the Resident Evil 2 remake and stuff like the Resident Evil 4 remake, it's like, the modernizations that you see are like generally accepted modernizations in games. Like you're able to move and shoot at the same time and all these kinds of things. But it's like, but it's just enough. It doesn't break it where there's like a full-on dodge roll in Resident Evil 2 Remake. But like, because you can like aim a little bit more carefully and move, you know, in dual analog format and all this stuff, it still sort of, I think, retains the spirit of what the game is. And I think that's why people like those games so much, right? Because it doesn't deviate from the formula so much. It doesn't add a layer of modernization that just doesn't fit the formula, you know?
Because there's an expectation, especially when handling older properties for people in handling memories, essentially.
I wouldn't even say the Final Fantasy VII remake does the same thing, in the sense that it still respects what it is, but it's modernized in another way.
It's an appreciation.
This room just got way more aggressive. Man, I hate the FF7 remake.
Really?
Whoa!
I hate it so bad. That's one of those scenarios where I went in thinking, with the word, I think Yahtzee said it best from Zero Punctuation. If you were expecting a remake of the game Final Fantasy VII because you played the Final Fantasy VII remake, you were poorly mistaken. Mm-hmm. Like, it is not what I would say anything like FF7. What it feels like to me is Tetsuya Nomura essentially saying, oh, I could do better. I could do way better than this. Mm. Final Fantasy VII has such a deeply personal story.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was so just viscerally emotional. And FF7 Remake is a Nomura-written project.
Yes.
And it feels like Nomura. And it's not that Nomura doesn't produce good media, but he certainly doesn't produce good FF7.
Just to add a layer of specificity here.
Yeah.
When I was saying the comparison, I was talking mechanically, not necessarily narratively.
I see. Okay.
Narratively.
So like, for example, in combat, it is active, like you are controlling the character, it's real time, but you can pause and menu.
You can slow it down, you're still messing with materia, all this stuff.
Story wise, it kind of got all over the place there, you know what I mean?
The last quarter of that game can truly get fucked, personally.
Yeah. For sure, for sure. My wife, no joke, so me and huge FF7 fan. You know, my entire arm.
I've been looking at it the whole time. The Shiva Ifrit is so cool.
Huge, me and my wife are mega into it. She has a Bahamut on her thigh.
Oh, that's awesome.
With a Moogle riding a Chocobo running away from it like a little dust cloud.
That's awesome. Amazing.
Very cool. So like, we're huge into Final Fantasy. And when the FF7 remake came out, we were both, I mean, just in it, you know?
Yeah.
And even with a lot of the press, obviously, showing us what it really was, I was like, okay, I'm not going to pay attention to the trailers. It's got to be better than it looks. And we started it up in that first like hour, 2 hours. Wow.
That's
good. Yeah. You know? That first bombing run on the
reactor. Bombing mission
when the song
is the best
hits, dude, when the music hits, it's so different.
That's the moment we were all waiting for, all those E3s where we were expecting the
PS3 tech demo that teased us for years.
It's what we all wanted. But then you have to keep playing, and it was not what we all wanted. Yeah, and but once we got to just before the Shinra building, when you're in the sewer right before the Shinra building, I had to talk my wife into playing. She's like, "We don't have to finish."
Oh,
and I'm like, "Whoa, that's
I will
pretty
say,
damning."
I was going into Final Fantasy VII not thinking similarly to what you were talking about with Silent Hill. Mm-hmm. I was thinking that this is going to be a different game, which means that I'm preserving and sanctifying and protecting my understanding and love of 1997 and Final Fantasy VII back in the day.
It
had to be.
I should have approached it. Yeah.
I mean, you're talking to guys like, I mean, when I met Justin in college, I was replaying Final Fantasy VII annually. Like, it was like a thing that I did every year. It was that was my special
tradition.
Like, this is my replay time, you know
what
I mean?
Final Fantasy VII played into how me and my wife met. We met in high school in a Spanish class, which was hilarious because I speak Spanish and she had a better grade than me. But I met her in Spanish class and she was reading the manual for Final Fantasy VII because she used to bring game manuals to read when she had nothing to do.
Dude, you are dating yourself so crazily.
Did the same. That's amazing.
But like, I met her in high school and I was like, oh, what are you reading? Because she was super hot. So I was like, gonna come up and talk to her. And what are you reading? And she was reading the Final Fantasy VII manual, which was already just like Cupid's arrow straight to the heart. And then she pulls down her headphones, which she was listening to, and she was listening to Morbid Angel. And I was just like, oh, God.
It's like, hey, so.
So I essentially decided.
You don't know this before we get married, I swear.
Like, no, I told her, like, month six of us, like, because we hung out as friends first. I was like, you know we're going to get married, right? You're aware of the fact?
Yeah.
I was like, I mean, because I just knew straight from, not before, like, when we started dating, I knew, when I met her, you know? So it was one of, I mean, you don't, when the universe gives you signs like that,
you know, she's listening to death metal, you gotta perk up, you know?
Reading FF7 manual, it's like,
all right,
someone's gonna snatch that up.
I'm gonna say it again. You guys are cute as fuck. Goddamn.
We're pretty adorable. I won't lie.
And now you live in Japan, and now, oh my God, and the story of. So you were originally from Alabama, and then.
No. I am originally from Miami.
Okay.
But, I have family, so I'm Cuban and like half and half.
Okay.
So I have my very redneck side of my family, the entire Bible Belt. You know, Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee.
I see.
And then there's the Florida family. And then for my entire life, I've either lived over here, over here, over here.
I see,
here.
Yeah.
So I've lived in Tennessee and Georgia and Alabama and Miami and Naples. And
so you met your wife in Florida.
Yes.
And then from there, 2 years ago now or a year ago?
About a year ago, yeah.
And you're just like, hey, it's time to move to Japan. And now your guests are here.
It was a lot, again, it was a lot her idea. Because, I mean, my goal was to live in Japan. But the same way when we got married, it was just like a dream.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you can just live there, you know.
Well, nobody actually thinks about what is required to do the thing. And now I'm seeing things on my Instagram account that's like, did you know you can buy like an abandoned building in Japan for really cheap and then
turn it into a house?
Yeah, right. And I'm like, oh my God, the possibility. You already put it in your mind. You like solidify it in your mind that that's a dream that's like so far off. You're not even going to entertain the idea.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It was like, you know, everybody's has a bucket list. I'll live in Japan. That's a bucket list. But the specifics, you know, when you get down to it, you don't think about. And then she goes, hey, you work from home. YouTube has like, what we did was, is we let YouTube, I did it full time while working full time for a calendar year to make sure.
It was just a stack up season for you. Yeah.
Just to make sure that like, if I was going to pursue it, because if I was going to quit my job, you know, we would still be able to pay our
rent. You'd have to know what you to expect, kind of.
To make sure that we weren't just dipping our toes in. That was like a full dive in the deep end.
Yeah.
So I worked a full-time job, did YouTube full-time, and I was getting my my degree because I thought that I would have to work as an English teacher here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You have to have a college degree to get an English teaching job here.
Okay.
So I was doing all three at the same time. And when I finally finished with college, I kind of just bummed around. I did YouTube full time and I was like a stay at home cat dad. And, I loved that life. And then my wife was like, you know, you'll never have another opportunity like this to kind of live mobily and work mobily. We should move to Tokyo. And I was like, you know what? You're right. And she handled a lot of the logistics, which is where I do not. I don't thrive in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
So she handled a lot of the logistics. And it's, I mean, mostly like her work that got us the visas here and everything.
Yeah. See, this is such a lesson in like finding a good partner, right? Because it's like you could have these ideas, but then when they're like, no, this is not a crazy thing. Then you're like, oh, wait, it's not a crazy thing.
She pulls down her headphones and she's like, we're moving to Japan. The paperwork's done.
From that moment to now, the straight line,
That's outstanding. That's amazing.
That's fantastic. I'm going to subtitle this podcast, How to Live the Dream, in an interview with Jared from Evelyn.
Greatest story ever told.
Jared, I would like to say, man, I'm not sure if maybe this is a good time to start wrapping up.
Yeah.
But it was like, one, when we were coming to Japan, I was just super excited to, one, come here with Justin. It's always been a dream of his, and also I've always wanted to return. Mm. And then when you told me a year ago that you were coming, you told it to the world. I was like, fantastic, that's amazing, outstanding.
Yeah.
And then when we were coming, I was just like, Jared, what are you up to? Come on, it's time to meet for real.
Yeah.
Dude, this has been a fantastic conversation. It's been really nice to meet you.
Super fun. Hell yeah, man. I appreciate you guys having me.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. We will, I don't know, maybe our next trip around, we'll make it happen again.
Please.
Yeah, if you're ever in the New York City metropolitan area, you know, that's where we're at.
But if you never came, I would understand. There's nothing there that you can't get.
That's right. I'm glad you made the comment because I would have otherwise.
Yeah.
There it is.
I don't go to the U.S. very often, but, I mean, working YouTube, at some point, business has to take me somewhere where business is.
There it is.
If you start going to, like, PAXs and stuff, we're always there, too, so.
You know, I probably should.
Really fun.
Dude, I mean, have a lot of fun at those.
It's not even just fun from the gaming perspective or the networking perspective. It's really, well, actually, I'm going back to the gaming perspective. It's really fun to see all these indie teams, like, battling with each other with their amazing ideas, and they're, like, just trying to like discuss like what they want to add to the industry, and it's fascinating. It's like the liveliest, like, I wouldn't say cutting edge, but almost like cutting edge part of the culture. I really love PAX.
I got to play Signalis at Tokyo Game Show.
Oh, really?
That's the closest I've come to what you guys are describing, and it was pretty cool.
Yeah, to see that stuff early is like it's really awesome, and it's also like you get to meet the people that are doing it. So then, you know, it adds this extra layer of kind of like closeness about it. It's a cool thing.
And to meet other people with the same level of passion, but with so much interest in education and information on such other niches, you start to fill out your understanding of like the video game industry in such a much more full and wholesome way. It's just really interesting.
Which should only be good for the content, being right. able to there like, come at it from an understanding perspective.
There it is.
So in like, what, a week and a half or so? Let's see if we can grab dinner with everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. 100%. That's absolutely. A yes, guaranteed. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That'd be mega fun.
Well, Jared, tell our listeners where they can find you, what you're up to, you know, the best places to engage with your content and the things that you do.
Yeah, YouTube, Avalanche Reviews. You'll know it's me. It's a sprite-based, bald-bearded guy. For that. It's very easy to find me on there. I do have a Twitter. I guess, do you call it Twitter anymore?
Is it an X? We're still calling it
We're
Twitter.
We're not calling it X.
Okay. We are dying on this hill.
I don't like the idea of Z-ing.
So. Yeah, no.
So I do have a Twitter, Avalanche Jared, Jared. I usually argue with people on Twitter, though. So come with a good argument. I think that's it, though. That's all I really use.
Very cool. Well, check out all of Jared's content. There's a heaping helping of survival horror, RPG, all your technical specs when it comes to retro stuff. He'll bring you. You'll start to build up your library of party facts. The kind of stuff that Jared will teach you. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on this week's podcast. Everyone else, we will catch you next week. I'm sure you're listening to Alex and Liz hold down the fort on our normal podcast.
The Vantacast.
Yes, check out critrate.io to get your gaming personality profile and meet others like you to find gaming recommendations. But until next time, thank you, Jared, and thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
Peace out.
We'll see you on the next one. Bye, everybody.